on the panel is because my publishers are very eager for me to go, I wrote this book, and it's a lovely little story about incarcerated women, and if you buy it, you will be supporting a worthy cause.
Okay. So you've never done time.
Oh yeah. Oh, okay. I've probably got not.
No, but you should say what you did, what your criminal history is.
I was a goofball.
That's illegal.
The kind of goofball I was. And I began my criminal career very, very young. When I first left the country at 16, I ended up in Scandinavia. And the only people who were anything like me were Rom, or Romani. So I began happily moving items from one country to another. Probably the funnest one was moving vodka out of Russia into Finland, which at that point was a dry and it was fun. And then when I came back to the United States for a moment, I said, this sucks. And proceeded to get very active with the Vietnam Day Committee and sat in lots and had a ball. And then I said, the revolution didn't come. So I left the country again. And then I discovered that I very much enjoyed leaving the country. And one way to afford this was actually to continue to move items of all kinds. Which is what I did for 10 years. And then at a certain point, because I wasn't really that good of a criminal or anything like that, my job is to have a good time. So I went down for a big bust, and I was given 10 years. And went to Frontera, which was at that point the only state prison. And the reason I was sent to Frontera was that had I gone federal, I would have done a great deal less time. And they didn't like me because I had...
What year was that?
Oh, this was in the 70s. Because I had a political dossier which was handed out to all the jurors. I ended up in Frontera and had a marvelous time and wrote a book about the resistance behind the walls in a very insubordinate way. I loved the women that I did time with. There's some jerks, but there's jerks out here. I think that the main thing that I wanted to bring out when I wrote the book was a rebellious, powerful, loving female culture put into a pressure cooker, and the choices that we made and the support that we gave each other. And the first version of Low Bite, I had written 60 pages and I handed it off to one of my friends I'd done time with. And she called me up and she said, after reading it, I had to lay down and I put a cold rag on my forehead. And she said, you were puking on the page here. And she said, I remember us having a lot of fun in spite of the situation. She says, there's none of that. This is 60 pages of sheer, unrelieved horror. And I went, oh, you're right. And she goes, nobody who hasn't done time is gonna wanna read this except for a real psychopath. And I said, well, maybe I'm writing for the psychopaths of the world. And she said, they don't buy books. And it was with that in mind that I attempted to put a lot of dark humor in it, the whole wise-ass female fundamental reaction to the horror that's around us. So, that's the deal with the book and with me.
And how long did you stay there?
I probably did in all about 6 years. In Frontera, I was only in 4. And
you got out when?
Late 70s. And of course, when I got out, I was in no way a good civilian. So that I did spend the next 20 years in and out.
Okay. My name is Bo Brown. Let's see. What are important facts about me? I'll be 63 in about 3 weeks.
Oh, happy birthday, Ernie.
I'll just do a brief little history too, because it all makes, I like what you were saying about how we survive in spite of this shit. I grew up in Southern Oregon in a logging town. Klamath Falls, Oregon was owned by Weyerhaeuser. In the 50s, I was born in 47. We lived in the mill community. If it had been the century before, it would have been the mill town. You know, they would have owned everything, the store and everything else. My parents were escapees from the South after World War II. My mother was the first female in either family that graduated from high school. And the only reason she got to do that is because there was a war. Because she didn't have to get married at 15 or something. So that presented her with the opportunity to go to high school, which she did. And she was a poet, actually. But that didn't save her. She met my father instead. And he swept her off her feet, and they came out west. Him and his friend came out west to, you know, find a job, a better job, a better life. Because they grew up during the Depression, and they had a lot of scarcity issues, let's say. And they were serious scarcity issues, because they didn't have any money. And they didn't have any jobs, and neither did their families. My grandfather on my mother's side was about 40 years older than my grandmother. And he was what was called in those days a tinker. And he could repair musical instruments, and he could play them. But when the Depression comes, nobody's going to get their musical instrument repaired. So they were pretty hungry. My father, my mother's side of the family, what I know is they're French. There's a little Spanish. There's a little this and a little that. It's only traceable about 2 or 3 generations. That's very common for the working class in America. We don't know where we came from because our shit is not traceable. My father's side of the family, let me see if I can get this little shit straight. I met my great-grandparents one time, and they were, all that I remember is I was about 8 or 10, and they were crooked little people that lived in a crooked little house, and my grandfather took me for a ride in his buckboard. And this was, remember, this was probably like 1955, maybe. And his major means of transportation was a horse. And they lived in this little house, and they had a wood stove, and they smoked those corn cob pipes, and they spit a lot, and they made hella good biscuits. That's about what I remember of them. That's the only time I ever saw them. My grandmother, my father's mother, I don't know exactly where she lived. It was kind of in the country. And my grandfather, who I never met, he was working on some crew that was chopping down trees in the area. They were like doing whatever. And she would watch them go by every day. So her and him flirted, whatever that means. They would leave notes in a tree or something. And so when he got ready to go, I think she was about 15 or something. When they got ready, those men got ready to go somewhere else, he told her to run away with him, and she did. Boy, that was bad. And I don't even know how old she was, actually, but probably 16. So she had a daughter and a son. And my grandfather would have these fits, and they didn't know what they were, and he became very violent. And so she left him. She got a divorce in 1930, which was unheard of in America. She met this man. I have no idea where she met him, but I'm sure he was older than her too. And he already had 10 kids. So they got married, and black people after the Civil War were called sharecroppers, and they got this much land and a little garden. And white people who didn't have any money were called truck farmers, and then they got a little more land and a little bit more garden. Okay. And being that it was the South, of course, the truck farmers thought they were better than the sharecroppers. So that's how the racism broke down. But really, it was about class and race. And so he had 10 kids, and they were all older. He married her, she had 2 kids, and then they had 2 more kids. So there was 14 kids. And then there was the Depression. So they didn't do too well in the Depression. And my father's stepfather was very, very, very mean to him. Very mean. Tortured him. And he ran away when he was 8 years old. And he ran away to the North because he knew what the South was about. And he ended up in the coal mine somewhere, and because he was 8 years old, he became their kid canary, and they sent him down in the coal mine. And if he came back, then they would continue to excavate that mine. But he didn't like that very well. He stayed there a couple years, and then he went back. I don't think he ever lived with my grandmother again, and his stepfather. But he lived in the area. And he dropped out of school when he ran away at 8 years old, or 10 years old or something, and he never went back to school. Many, many years later, he was diagnosed as dyslexic. So he never learned to read, 'cause he couldn't. And by the time he figured that out, they told him it was impossible for him to learn how to read because it would have been too many years, right? Because he was like in his 50s or something. So when World War II came along, he lied and joined the Navy. And they sent him to Pearl Harbor after the bombing. And he stayed there. I think they found out that he wasn't 18. The story I remember, now who knows? I mean, stories are stories. The story I remember is that him and this guy were cleaning a submarine. They got drunk and passed out in the submarine. And when they woke up, the submarine was headed to Japan. So they said, oh, shit. And so they went and told them they weren't old enough, right? So they brought somebody out to get them, and they took them back to the islands. And he stayed there throughout the war.